Hello and welcome to The Road to Autonomy. The Road to Autonomy is brought to you in part by Stantec Generation AV. Stantec Generation AV combines some of the most experienced AV experts in the industry with the resources of a global engineering firm. Stantec Generation AV provides education, consulting, assessment, and guidance to any industry interested in autonomous vehicles. Learn more at Stantec.com. Hello and welcome to The Road to Autonomy. I'm your host, Grayson Brulte. On today's episode, we're absolutely honored to have Harry Campbell, the rideshare guy. Harry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here and chat with you and hopefully enlighten your audience.
Well, I'm excited because years and years ago, you and I at the Hotel Bel Air, we recorded one for the Rideshare Guy podcast, which was a ton of fun. So returning the favor. So thanks for coming on, because we had a lot to talk about your industry, because the rideshare industry is currently in flux.
Though I will say, I feel like that interview was, what, 5 or 6 years ago? So it kind of took you a while to repay the favor, but I guess better late than never.
It's better late than never. And plus, the traffic's larger now, so you're going to get a larger bang. I'll say a better bang for your buck. How's that?
All right, let's do it.
Harry, as I said earlier, the rideshare business is in flux, which raises the question, what is the current state of the rideshare business?
I think that the pandemic has obviously ebbed and flowed, and rideshare has been one of those industries that has been most severely affected by the pandemic, right? You think about at the beginning of the pandemic, we knew nothing. CDC was telling people like, hey, don't be closer than 6 feet, stay outside, things like that. And when you think about an Uber or Lyft driver, it's like, okay, passenger gets into the car, they're breathing on your neck, right? So it was kind of like immediately some issues. Since those early days of the pandemic, I think what's really one thing that has kind of defined the rideshare industry is this shortage of drivers, this shortage on the supply side. And this extends to the macro environment too, right? Many industries, you know, across the board have kind of reported for various reasons, which we can get into, that they can't hire enough workers. And Uber and Lyft have been no stranger to that. And so I think what we've really seen at this time is that, hey, demand has gone up and down. And for the most part, I think demand has, it's not quite where it was pre-pandemic, but it's come back. Prices are up because there aren't enough drivers to meet that demand. And I think honestly, like the product itself, the rideshare product of Uber and Lyft, it's the past 2 years has been one of the only times where the product wasn't that great. It wasn't as reliable. The pricing was too high. But you don't have a lot of great alternatives. I mean, how weird would it feel right now to call up a friend or a family member and say, I need a ride to the airport? That's like still taboo. But you can struggle to get an Uber, or you can struggle to get a Lyft. So it's like things are getting done and there's still rides happening, but it's really not as flawless as it used to be. Pricing is a lot higher. Drivers still, you know, there still aren't enough drivers. Drivers in Los Angeles, Uber says they're averaging $30 an hour, including all online time. We have our top contributor in LA, Sergio. He's earning $50 to $60 an hour right now driving in LA because there's such high demand. There's not enough drivers. There's surge pricing. There's bonuses, right? And so it's still, it's kind of an interesting time in that respect.
So you take your average driver in LA earning $30 an hour. We currently have inflation pegged at 8.3%. We have the average price of gasoline 4.60%. California, I'm going to go on a limb, over $6. Even at $30 an hour, by the time you do insurance, maintenance, is it even profitable to be a rideshare driver today with the current economic circumstances?
For sure. I think it's definitely profitable. And I will say one of the things that kind of defines the gig economy is that there's a ton of variability. If you kind of understand the actual hard numbers, let's look at before the pandemic, Uber in the city of Seattle released a ton of actual driving data. And the top earners in the city of Seattle, this is actual Uber driver data, were earning $40 an hour. And the bottom were around $7 to $8 an hour. This is before expenses. So imagine you have a job where people are literally doing the same thing. They're driving for Uber. They might be driving at different times and different places and very different strategies, but one person might be making 4 to 5 times X another person, right? And so that's kind of what defines the gig economy, is that there's a ton of variability on the income side, right? Think about a Starbucks barista. Everyone goes in on day one. They all make $17 an hour, right? Some are good, some are bad, but they all make the same amount and they have no expenses. And when you think about expenses, there's a ton of variability on the expense side too. The number one most popular vehicle in the surveys of thousands of drivers that we've done, Grayson, can you guess what it is?
Toyota Prius?
Boom. You hit the nail on the head. And you know what? I didn't even give you any hints. So that was totally organic. Toyota Prius is the most popular vehicle, 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon. So if you're a full-time driver in LA with a Toyota Prius that you bought maybe 2 or 3 years old and you got a great financing deal on, I mean, your cost of ownership of that vehicle might be $2-3 an hour. It might be $4-5 an hour with a vehicle that has higher MPG, or if you got or lower MPG, or you didn't get as great a vehicle, right? And so in a time where drivers are averaging 30 an hour in LA, those expenses, obviously it sucks to pay higher gas prices, but it's still a small percent. It's when you get down into the tier two markets, because most of the demand for Uber and Lyft and rideshare is in the big New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Washington, D.C. They still operate in every other city. And so it's in those smaller to medium-sized cities where you don't get as good of bonuses as a driver. You don't see as higher rates. Gas might still be high. Cost of living is a little lower, but that market can be different. So it's kind of interesting how much variability there is market to market, driver to driver, income to income, and also expenses to expenses. So when you add all of that up, you can sort of see how some drivers say, hey, this is the worst job in the world. And others like Sergio are making $50 to $60 an hour driving 20 hours a week in Los Angeles.
How do the drivers make up for gas prices that continue to rise? Does Uber and Lyft put a surcharge on? How do those drivers make up for that additional cost?
Well, so what's interesting is that Uber and Lyft ended up instituting a fuel surcharge that was about 40 to 50 cents per trip. But before they instituted that fuel surcharge, we did a big survey of our audience. And a number of drivers, actually, as you might imagine, I think close to half of drivers said they quit driving or were driving less. And then about 10 to 20% of drivers actually said they were driving more. And it didn't really make sense at first, right? Okay, gas prices are up. Why would they be driving more? But for the drivers who are actually reliant on driving for Uber and Lyft, if gas prices go up, they don't have a lot of choice. They're literally going to be making less money, right? Let's say you're driving 40 hours a week and you have fixed expenses. Now your expenses go up. You're earning less on the next week. And so those drivers kind of have to drive more to make up for that difference. So I think that's kind of one of the downsides that a lot of drivers have always complained about, and probably rightfully so over the years, is that the companies set your rates. So they tell you how much you're going to make. And then they have a per mile and a per minute, and they offer bonuses every week. You have no control. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're bad. Drivers in the smaller to medium markets always complain that they don't get any bonus offers. And so as a driver, if your expenses are going up and you have to work this job, you don't have a lot of choice. You got to put more hours on your car. You got to do more trips. You got to do more rides. And so that's sometimes some of the downside, right? When you're working for these platforms, is that they can give you a lot of demand, but you don't always have a lot of say in what you're making for those rides or a lot of the control that you might in a true independent contractor type relationship.
Do drivers try and get more control by operating a black market? Hi, Harry. Nice to meet you. I see that you're in this area and then you cut a cash deal. It's happened to me, so it happens. So is that widespread?
For sure. I would say that I don't know how widespread it is. I would say that it definitely happens. I mean, I think the most common situations for a driver would be things like airport rides. So if you think about, I'll use Los Angeles as an example, since I'm based here in LA, most of the rides actually happen in the higher socioeconomic areas, right? Basically where rich people live, that's where rides are happening, and food delivery. And so if you look at the demand maps, it's all West Los Angeles, Hollywood, downtown, Santa Monica, South Bay. But drivers, even if you're making 15, 20, 30 bucks an hour before expenses, they can't afford to live in those multi-million dollar neighborhoods, right? And so they live north in the valley, east out in sort of inner part of LA County or even further out, and then south. And so a lot of drivers that drive into the city and back home every single day. So you could imagine if someone needs a ride from the airport. So if you get a ride from the airport at 4 a.m. from way out east, you know, an hour east of LA, all the way into LAX, that person is like, maybe they're a business traveler. They go every Monday. Those are the types of trips where a driver's like, hey, I normally drive empty, you know, into the city. So, hey, I'm happy to give you a ride for $50 cash. If it normally Uber charges you 75 or 80, we'll cut out Uber. And frankly, in those situations, that's technically an illegal ride because you need a for hire license and commercial insurance, but there's almost minimal risk to the driver. It's more the situations where, you know, a passenger is flagging you on the side of the street. And as an Uber driver, you really don't want to be picking up those types of passengers and doing rides off the app. But a lot of drivers do look for those sort of pre-scheduled rides in situations where it kind of provides an outsized benefit to them, if that makes sense.
And they're providing a benefit for the individual that needs to get there. I was in an Uber in LA, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and this gentleman was telling me there was a lawyer from LA and was doing a trial in Santa Ana, California. And every day, Monday through Friday, 5 days a week, this Uber driver drove him down. He paid a fat rate. And then during the trial, he was Ubered and then he took him home. And the guy said it worked out because it was consistency. So the driver made more money. The lawyer got to go to his court case. Hopefully he won his court case. Don't know. But it was one of those interesting stories that you learn from talking to drivers. And you gave me the advice a long time ago. Talk to the drivers and see what you can learn. And during that time, I've spoken to a lot of drivers, continue to talk to, and have some really wonderful conversations. The number one thing that's on my mind now is a slowing economy and a possible recession on the horizon. Are drivers actively preparing for what a recession will look like and what impact it could potentially have on their earnings?
I think that's a great point, and I'll be honest, unfortunately not. I think there's sort of the obvious issues around inflation and gas prices going up, but one thing that we've also heard from drivers who have had to take their cars in for repairs is that they can't get parts. They can't get brakes or certain parts that they needed for repairs, whether they got into an accident or just general maintenance. And we think about a driver, I mean, their car is their livelihood. So if you get into an accident, the difference between getting back on the road in 1 week versus 3 weeks is 2 weeks of lost income, right? You're already losing out on a week of income, and you literally have no option to drive if your car is in the shop or if you can't get the parts that are needed. And so I think that it really takes some sort of savvy planning. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these drivers, even though they may be earning more during the pandemic, frankly, like this type population, they're more of a day-to-day earner. One of the most popular features for Uber drivers is actually called Instant Pay. And this allows you to go from weekly pay to cashing out instantly whenever you want. So if I go and do a day's worth of trips, I make $150, I can pull that money out. I can go do one trip and pull that money out instantly in sort of a reverse ATM transaction. And this has been probably one of the top two most popular products that Uber has ever released for drivers. And it kind of highlights the fact that these drivers are very sensitive to prices going up and down, bills that need to be paid, rent, just their general expenses. And so I think that the idea of them socking away money for retirement in the future, or, you know, sort of these non-compulsory, right? Like you have to pay taxes. Okay, there's not much you can do about that. You have to pay your monthly insurance to keep on driving, but you don't have to save for retirement. You don't have to save money in an emergency fund in case your vehicle breaks down. So I think it's sort of like, or inflation goes up in the future, right? So it's sort of easy for a lot of drivers to forego some of the kind of rainy day type savings or sort of funds that they should be putting away. So I do think that that has and will play an impact if we are to see things kind of go up in the future.
To give you a sad analogy, there's sports stars in the NFL, MLB, NFL that make millions of dollars and they blow it all and there's nothing to go there. And then I believe it's during the NFL combine they get financial classes. Does Uber offer any sort of financial classes for these drivers to help them prepare every time, even if it's $10 a week or just to start getting in the habit of starting to save something to prepare for that, you want to call it a rainy day fund?
That's actually a good point, is that I think this issue and some of the issues within the gig economy are not necessarily exclusive to the gig economy. You see this, I'm not throwing Uber and Lyft drivers under the bus here. I think that there are a lot of people who they don't save for a rainy day fund. I think there's a lot of stats that people can't cover an emergency fund type expense, $500, for example. So I think that that is not necessarily exclusive here. And Uber doesn't provide much, if anything, in the way of financial literacy or training. And I think that in kind of a pessimistic outlook that they don't want to either. If you sort of give drivers the full picture of what you're earning, hey, you made $30 an hour last week, but you drive a piece of shit car and it cost you $8 an hour, your net earnings were actually only $22 an hour. People start thinking like, oh, maybe this job isn't so great. It's actually like, because it's so difficult to calculate what your vehicle costs, I think it kind of obfuscates what you're actually earning. And one of the reasons why many drivers do end up quitting is that they're putting a lot more miles on their car. I mean, believe it or not, Uber and Lyft drivers put a lot of miles on their car. A full-time driver will easily do 1,000 miles a week or more. Compare that to the average driver who puts 1,000 miles a month on their car. So that would be 12,000 miles a year. And even that is a little bit on the high end. So Uber and Lyft drivers, full-time Uber and Lyft drivers are doing 4 to 5x the number of miles a normal driver would do. And so you think about that in the context of brake jobs, oil jobs, even just general maintenance and things that might break, right? Like I'm not a car guy, but the timing belt broke and what the hell is that, right? The serpent belt, you know, all these things that can kind of go wrong and you end up paying for, right? So those types of issues definitely add up, right?
So you're driving 4 to 5 times more than the average driver. Does the insurance go up by 4 to 5 times as much?
What's interesting when it comes to insurance, drivers can actually onboard onto the platform. So Uber and Lyft with regular personal insurance. So for example, when I signed up to drive with Uber, I had Geico insurance and I submit my insurance to Uber and Lyft. Geico never actually doesn't know that I'm driving for Uber and Lyft. And technically, all personal policies do not allow livery, which is for hire driving. So technically, I am not supposed to be driving for Uber and Lyft with a personal personal policy. And where this comes into play is that during what they call, so period one, so this is when, if I'm just driving around, Geico covers me, no problem. As soon as I turn the app on though, the Uber app on, and I'm waiting for a request, Uber calls this period one. And so that's where personal insurers do not want to cover you because they feel that you're driving for Uber and Lyft. And Uber and Lyft provide state minimum liability coverage. So that might be 25K, 50K, and they provide no collision. So basically, if you get into an accident during period one, you're kind of screwed as a driver. And so that's where a lot of, we recommend to our audience, for example, to go and get a rideshare insurance policy. So this would be something that covers you for that period one gap, and then either covers you while you're driving for Uber and Lyft, or it allows Uber and Lyft to cover you during that period two and three. So we've surveyed our audience, and about half of drivers end with rideshare insurance, which means unfortunately half don't. And this is another good example of, it's not compulsory to get rideshare insurance. So unfortunately, we hear from a lot of drivers, they get into an accident with Uber and Lyft. Uber and Lyft have a $2,500 collision deductible. So they'll cover you $1 million liability, but whether you're at fault or not, you're going to have to shell out $2,500 to get your car repaired. How many drivers have $2,500 cash? How many people have $2,500 cash on hand? That's a lot of money, whereas normal personal policies are $500 to $1,000. So it can be challenging, but there are a number of startups that we're working with, like Buckle Insurance. I just interviewed a company on my podcast called Stable Insurance. They're launching a new rideshare insurance product in Illinois that actually allows you to buy down that $2,500 deductible. So they'll cover you during period one. And if you get into an accident during period two or three, they'll allow you to pay a little extra per month, and you can only pay $500, for example, and Uber will still cover you.
It seems what you're describing here, on day one, a rideshare driver is not prepared. They don't necessarily have the financial literacy. They don't understand the economic consequences of a faulty insurance. I'm a very big fan of really good insurance. My wife has a great line called sleep at night, because then you don't have to worry. How do we change that circumstance? Is that where you're out there educating drivers? Hey, if you want to become a rideshare driver or a gig driver, please buckle up and, by the way, get really good insurance.
Well, I think what you're describing is the fact that rideshare drivers, whether they realize it or not, they're business owners. And running a business is tough. There's a reason why, you know, what's the stat? 90% of businesses do not make it past the first year or whatever it might be. There's a lot of considerations. And frankly, you know, most people aren't qualified to run a business. You and I have been running a business for multi-years, and it's challenging, right? There's ups and downs. There's people you have to pay. There's liability. There's taxes. There's all these things. And so I think what is interesting is that, frankly, Uber and Lyft, they kind of want to make it as easy as possible to get started in the gig economy. And that's what they do. So you sort of have this bifurcation where a lot of people, driving for Uber and Lyft can be very simple and very easy. You sign up with the companies in a few hours or less, you're approved, you're out delivering, or you're out driving within a day or two. You can get a virtual inspection. You can never leave your house and be approved. You can go do one ride, cash out money to your bank account. There are a lot of positive aspects and a frictionless experience. But if you kind of start digging down and want to be really successful over the long term, you have to start thinking about all these other considerations. And so, for example, in the book that I wrote called The Rideshare Guide, where we kind of do an A to Z guide for Uber and Lyft drivers, we're very realistic about it. Like, we don't expect drivers on day one to go out and get a phone mount, dash cam, rideshare insurance, start tracking all their miles, like all the things that they should do. It's like, hey, day one, or day zero, actually, go call an Uber ride, right? Like, take a ride as a passenger, get used to how the app works, talk to a driver. Day one, you're approved to drive for Uber and Lyft, get a phone mount. That's reasonable, right? Like, get a phone mount, put your phone up there. Day seven, get a dash cam. Day 14, think about rideshare insurance. Day 30, go out there, make sure you're doing Uber and Lyft provides some mileage tracking capability, but you probably want to get a free app that'll help you, right? So it's sort of like you ease into things. And that's kind of how we educate our audience and drivers kind of around the world, really, about what it takes to be successful. Because we do see a pretty big barbell, and Uber and Lyft are kind of notorious for high churn. The fact that 2/3 of all drivers quit after 6 months, for example. So you have a lot of new drivers that are sort of out there trying to figure out the system. Like, I'm probably not making the job sound that great because there's all these considerations that you have. So frankly, that's why not a lot of drivers make it past the first 6 months. But the ones who do, like the veterans who stick around, oh man, these guys and gals, I mean, they'll be there for years, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, Sergio on my team, for example, has been driving in LA for 5, 6, 7 years. He took 2 years off during the pandemic, and he's like back now driving and making $50 to $60 an hour, right? So if you can figure out the system, you can definitely make it work for you.
I want to plug your book. I read your book. We had a wonderful lunch to celebrate your book coming out, and that was a lot of fun. I learned a lot from your book. That was the most important thing there. So I recommend Harry's book, and I'll put a link in the show notes for it.
And you know, it's cool, Grace. I just updated the book and released an Audible version too. So, and I met someone. I went to an insurance conference last week, and I'll give a shout out to my friend Ryan. He's the CMO at Cambridge Telematics. And he literally showed me, he was like, hey, I'm on chapter 7 of your audiobook right now. I'm like, oh, pretty cool.
See, you never know. You publish it and they listen. But getting on the insurance theme, I highly recommend if anybody's a rideshare driver, or get rideshare insurance on day one, because something could happen on the first day in that period and then you're in financial trouble. So it's worth spending the money
for sure
and doing it right.
And also what I think is interesting too is, like, I am a big proponent of, I don't like to tell people what to do. So it's sort of more like, hey, I understand. I mean, my overall outlook on the gig economy, I would say, is more positive than negative. It'd be probably not the smartest idea to build a huge business around telling people not to drive for Uber and Lyft. So if you ask me, I would say, yeah, go drive for them. But you've got millions of people driving for Uber and Lyft and working in the gig economy. And so it's sort of like, hey, if you want to do this job, I'm going to help you do it better. And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of more about I'm a big proponent of helping people understand the risk. So it's like, hey, illegal rides happen, right? Do people do rides off the Uber app? Yes. What are the risks of doing that? So for example, like, we do highlight stories, like if you're on your way to LAX and someone flags you for a ride, like, there have literally been like undercover operations by the city and the police to kind of get drivers. It's like, do not do that. But we know all the time, I'm not like telling people to go look for off the app rides, because those are technically illegal. But it's like, hey, if you find someone, and you know, we highlight stories of drivers, is like kind of what I described, like who get an airport ride or like the daily client, like, here is the risk. Like, technically you need a TCP license in the state of California. You need commercial insurance. What is your risk of getting caught in this situation? It's very low. And same thing with rideshare insurance. Like, if you don't have, you know, this is sort of like the tough choices that startups and businesses need to make. Like, there's a lot of things you need to do. You can't always do it at first. Like Uber, if they would have gone through all the rules and regulations at the start, they would have never got to the point where they are. They kind of had to break a few eggs to get where they were. They got a lot of, probably rightfully so, criticism for that. But you have to like make very tough trade-offs and understand, like, hey, if I have no financial assets at risk, for example, like, maybe getting additional insurance, like, if that is the difference between me being able to put food on my table or not, like, I'm probably not going to get that insurance at the start. At a certain point, when you build up your business and you have more, you have a house or you've got something actually at risk, because if you get into an accident, people don't want to sue you. They want to sue Uber. You'll be named in the lawsuit anyways. But if you've got actual assets at risk, you got to make sure you're protected. If not, it may be something that you don't protect.
When you say that the drivers, the number one features is instant pay, are there hidden fees? Do they have to pay 49 cents, 59 cents? Are there hidden fees to pull it out?
Yeah, so they charge 50 cents to cash out instantly. But if you get one of the direct debit cards with the companies that they offer, so Lyft has a partnership with a company called Payfare, for example, that does a direct debit card. If you get their debit card, then you can actually cash out for free, I believe, as often as you want. So there's a lot of really cool innovation happening in this kind of digital wallet space. I work with a startup called Lean that is basically partnering with a lot of platforms. And what it does that's so cool, it creates a digital wallet for work. So if I'm driving for Uber, I can now basically go sign up for a bank account with Lean. And then every time I get paid, instead of going to an intermediate, I just get the money in my account. So it's like automatic instant pay. And then these companies like Lean, but also others in the fintech space, are negotiating really good 2% interchange fees, for example, on debit cards. And so then they can actually rev share with the platforms like Uber or Lyft. So it sort of goes from you paying fees to now getting it for free instantly after every job. And the companies are actually if you make $1,000 a week and they're spending, you get 2% of that. And it's not costing anyone, because that's what you would have gotten anyways in a normal bank account from the interchange fees, it's now an extra $20. And you add that up times millions of workers, it's a big revenue source. So there's some real cool opportunities in kind of that fintech space too, and partnering and allowing these drivers to cash out.
It's smart because there's encouragement. If somebody needs to make an extra $100 to pay the utility bill, they can go out and do some runs and then they could pay the utility bill. That changes a family's dynamic.
So one of my sort of future, I've got a lot of ideas on my business to-do list, but one of the things that I think is really interesting, that I've got a lot of expertise in the gig economy and sort of like really all the benefits of working in the gig economy. And I think there's like huge opportunities to extend some of these benefits to other industries. You see all this, these stories about Starbucks workers unionizing and Amazon, right? And so for example, like what are the features that gig workers love? Like it's the flexibility, it's this stuff like instant pay. How do you replicate those principles into other industries? So for example, like the last thing Uber and Lyft want to do is pay drivers more. It's like, hey, if we pay them more, we could improve our retention, but that's costs us more money. So how do we give them the perception of value? And instant pay is a perfect example of that. It's like, hey, I got my money. Instead of getting the same amount on Tuesday, I'm getting it today. I now feel better about that money that I'm getting, right? So I think there's a lot of really cool learnings from the gig economy that like instant pay, like it sounds like you had actually never heard of that feature. Like there's no reason that every single employer at McDonald's, Starbucks, every single one of those guys shouldn't be advancing pay basically at the end of a shift, at the end of a day. This technology is all out there and it would have huge positive impact on retention and happiness and everything that workers kind of care about beyond just paying them more.
That's going to be a political football in Congress. I'm going to let that one.
Well, so that might be my next book, sort of like taking these principles of what gig workers love and how to apply them to other industries.
Then you stir the pot and you get invited to testify in Capitol Hill. Here is the rideshare guide to the gig economy's hero.
Yeah, we'll see.
You'll never know where it goes.
I'll have to buy a suit.
Well, I think you'd be very fancy in a suit. That's your marketing. If you look at marketing, Uber and Lyft for years have just spent millions of dollars marketing. It's led to heavy losses. We're facing a new economic reality where it's not growth at all costs. It's cash flow. It's getting to being profitable. How will Uber and Lyft pivot to this new economic reality?
No, you definitely laid it out well. I mean, it is pretty crazy that there were times I tweeted the Lyft CEO the other day a joke about this campaign they ran where they actually offered new drivers $1,000 and the person like me who referred the new driver $1,000 after one trip. And as you might imagine, probably millions of people signed up for this offer. It completely was chaos and ended up being a huge nightmare because it was just too good of an offer. And that was 4 or 5 years ago. And it's sort of like, I think early on, they were really focused on just paying large amounts to acquire drivers. And I think the real shift over the past year that I've seen from Uber is they're focusing a lot more on retention, a lot more on loyalty. And so I talked about some of the issues when it comes to driving for Uber, but I think at the same time, these are also opportunities for the company. If I'm Uber and I've got a bunch of drivers that don't feel that loyal to the company when they call into customer support, they got to wait, right? It's like, hey, there's easy opportunities to start saying, hey, if you're a driver and you've done 25,000 trips and you've got a 4.9 star rating, boom, when you call in, you go to the front of the line. I mean, it's sort of like pretty basic, but a lot of these features or ideas that have been replicated in other industries, Uber has not done. So I almost see them as they've got a lot of room for improvement. So if you're an optimist, you would sort of look at that and say, hey, there's actually a lot of positives about working in the gig economy, kind of like how my book lays out, for example. Like in my book, I say, when your first day as a driver, like start on a Thursday afternoon when demand is low in an area that you know well. Don't start on Super Bowl Sunday. Don't take any Uber pool trips. Don't take any airport trips. Like you want your first day experience to be really solid. And Uber is starting to kind of build that into the product, like basically my book. So I don't know if I'm going to get any credit or royalties from it, but the concepts I think are pretty simple. So I think that's really where the companies have opportunities to pivot to. I think one of the challenges though, is that frankly, they've churned through a lot of workers. And when people leave the gig economy, when they leave Uber and Lyft, they're kind of pissed. They're not happy. It's like, oh man, this company screwed me, or oh, they deactivated me unfairly, or oh, I put 10,000 miles on my car in 2.5 months and now I owe thousands of dollars in repairs and I already spent all the money I made, right? And so they sort of burn a lot of bridges. And I think one thing early on is that I had this theory. I've been doing my website for 8 years. So this was early on, is that, hey, early on, there are a lot of stats that there 2/3 of drivers were quitting after 6 months and they had 1 million drivers. And I started doing the math. I used to be an engineer. It's like, how many people potentially can drive for Uber and have a eligible vehicle? Because that is a big requirement that you need kind of a newer four-door vehicle. I always assumed that they would run out. And after 4 or 5 years, they never ran out of drivers. And so I sort of gave up on that theory. And I since in the past 2 years during the pandemic, it seems like that may be one of the things that came back. A lot of rideshare drivers switched over to food delivery. A lot of people started getting unemployment and stimulus and investing in crypto and making money elsewhere. And it's like, hey, you know, driving for Uber, I think, is still a good job, but there's a lot of other opportunities there. And there's a lot of potential people that have frankly already driven for Uber or even worked in the gig economy and aren't necessarily looking. So I feel like that might be one of their bigger challenges on the supply side, is like, who do they hire going forward?
Both Uber and Lyft are going to face a lot of challenges. Lyft, for example, stock's down 60% year to date. They're under a lot of investor pressure. There was a leaked memo to the Wall Street Journal on May 24th. John Zimmer, the Lyft president, said the following: our near-term action plan will be focused on accelerating profits, whether we like it or not. That's a ticket of entry in today's market. Can Uber and Lyft ever become profitable based on the current way the businesses are structured?
I think it's actually pretty clear that rides, giving people rides, transporting people for money, is a pretty profitable business. I think you might need certain constraints. If you look at the taxi market in New York City, for example, going back 100 years, back in the day when it was like anyone and everyone could sign up and there were a bunch of jitney cabs, no one was making any money. Once they constrained it, they limited it to 13,000 medallions and taxi owners and sort of artificially limited the supply, people started making a lot of money. So I think transporting people for hire with certain constraints, reasonable, even reasonable constraints, is a profitable endeavor. But maybe the prices that Uber and Lyft have charged in the past are not sustainable. And I think one thing that we have seen during the pandemic, if you look at the numbers, so Uber, let's look at Uber, for example, they're not, as far as the number of rides they're doing on a daily, monthly basis, they're not quite recovered to where they were pre-pandemic, but the amounts that they're charging have gone up 20, 30, 40, 50%. Yipit data is a good source of a per ride amount, right? So it's sort of like what's happening is there are fewer rides happening than before, but they're charging more. And frankly, I don't think customers have a great alternative. We talked before about like, hey, if you want to get to the airport, like, what do you do? How do you get there if you don't take an Uber? Like, I know there are other options, but for a majority of people that are kind of like frequent Uber users, I do think they're aren't great alternatives. Taxis really haven't stepped in to fill this void. You're not like biking or walking or, you know, even try to drive your car to an airport. Like, where do you park? You got to park off campus. It's like a lot of friction versus if you look at an industry like food delivery. Like, I'm very bearish on food delivery because if it's expensive to order a burrito already and have a human go to a restaurant, pick up your food, drop it off at your house. Like, that's expensive for an $8 Chipotle burrito. And you've got a lot of alternatives. You can buy groceries. You can cook yourself. You can eat leftovers. You cannot eat. But like, how do you get to the airport when you need an Uber? I don't think there are a lot of great alternatives to rideshare. So I think they've shown that they actually do have a lot of pricing power. I think where it gets a bit confusing and maybe beyond my pay grade is that they're investing in a whole lot of other crap. They're investing in food delivery. They're making a big push. I don't know if you've noticed this year, they did a Super Bowl commercial around Uber Eats and basically this concept of get everything delivered. I mean, Uber has rides, they've got Eats. They purchased a company called Corner Shop that does grocery delivery in Latin America and is now expanding to the US under the Uber Eats brand. They've got alcohol delivery, right? There's all these other verticals that they're trying to get into under the Uber umbrella. They've got Uber Freight, for example, truck driving. So all of that stuff, I think, is much less profitable, or I'm very skeptical that like food delivery can be super profitable in the long run, for example, for the reasons I mentioned. And so I think that kind of muddies the waters when it comes to the profitability of rides.
So you're right. Uber has three main lines of business they break down. They break down their Eats business, their Rides business, and their Freights business. Let's start with Eats here because Eats did $8.3 billion in revenue in fiscal year 2021, an increase of 114% year over year. However, let's put the economic hat on here. EBITDA basis, the margins are only 1%. You cannot build a profitable business on a 1% margin. Imagine if Apple, 40-plus percent margins, was operating at 1%. Apple would not be the world's wealthiest company. Is Uber Eats dragging down Uber as they try and achieve profitability?
I think that that's a good way to look at it, is that on a unit economics basis, Uber Eats is dragging down Uber at the ride side of the business. And I think that for the reasons I mentioned, I'm very skeptical of food delivery. I think another good analogy, I mean, it's sort of like I look at a lot of these companies from the ground perspective. Like, I was one of the first DoorDashers in Orange County in 2015. Like, I've delivered food, I've eaten other people's fries, all the crazy stories you hear, like, I've done all that. And another thing that I've always been skeptical of in food delivery is that there's a lot of parties involved. There's the customer, there's the restaurant, there's the driver, there's Uber Eats, the platform. That's four parties involved in a relatively simple transaction. If you've ever played a game of telephone when you were little, you tell one person one thing, and then they tell the next person, and then you tell the next person, and then they tell the next person, like, what ends up happening, right? You order a burger and fries, and they forget the ketchup. Who's to blame? Like, I'm not eating a burger and fries without ketchup. Like, you got to have ketchup with your fries. And that's a tiny mistake, but I'm going to ask DoorDash for a refund. So if you actually notice, if you ever, for example, complain that something was off with your DoorDash order, their first line of response is just to refund you, or they'll give you a partial refund, because they know it's so challenging to basically navigate like the disputes. Who messed up? So it's almost cheaper for them to just give you money back. And if you go above, let's say the average in LA is like 20% of orders get messed up. And if you go above that threshold and you're complaining on every order, they'll start reviewing it and flagging it. But it kind of highlights just the fact that like how much can go wrong in food delivery. So I definitely think that the unit economics of food delivery, like I'm not a buyer of that all day long, even though DoorDash has sort of exploded. And the other thing, there's a lot of competition in the food delivery space. You've got DoorDash, you've got Uber Eats, you've got smaller companies like Grubhub, but then you're also competing with cooking food yourself, ordering groceries, like ordering pre-made food. Like there's not eating, eating leftovers, eating frozen pizza. There's a lot of competition, I think, that beyond the actual direct competition. So I think the big reason why Uber Eats or Uber pivoted to Uber Eats during the pandemic, rides were down, and it was a great growth narrative. I think this is a challenge that a lot of these startups, at a certain point, when you're raising money off of a growth narrative. You're not raising money off of the business today. You're like, hey, we can be a $100 billion business in the future when we have self driving cars, when we have Uber rides and Uber Eats and all of these different verticals. And I think the public markets are just sort of now saying like, hey, we don't care about growth. We want to know where you're at today. So I think that's sort of where Uber has been getting hammered. But I do think in a way, they're kind of like, people are forgetting that Uber has this super profitable rides business. And if I had to bet on one, like I would be betting on rides versus food delivery long-term any day of the week.
Okay. So you want to bet on rides. Now I'm going to turn the tables here, and we're going to put on the economic head. So you mentioned DoorDash. They've got a $27 billion market cap. They have $4.2 billion in cash and short-term securities on their balance sheet. Lyft, as I said, is down 60-plus percent year-to-date, $6.1 billion market cap. Does DoorDash make a run, take out Lyft, and then make a juggernaut to compete with Uber? Because I don't see how, in today's fundamental way it's structured, Lyft can compete with Uber.
I kind of like that idea. I will say that I think one thing, I'm definitely no stock picker or expert. I do a lot of investor calls, I guess you would say. So I've learned a lot from the folks that I'm frankly getting paid to chat with. But at the same time, I think that one thing that comes up over, you know, I've interviewed a lot of these executives and we've been pretty carefully following a lot of these expansion into new verticals, I guess you would say. It started with rides and then food delivery, then grocery delivery and instant delivery and alcohol and weed. You know, we've covered it all. I've literally had people on the ground trying weed delivery, alcohol delivery, driving for taxi. And I think the one thing it all boils down to at the company level is frequency. These companies really value customers who are frequent users. So rides and food delivery are too frequent sort of opportunities. You call a lot of rides, you have to eat 3 times a day, 2 to 3 times a day, versus ordering groceries. I mean, you might order groceries 1, 2, 3 times a week. The average ticket value with groceries is higher than food delivery, but I think the frequency is really interesting. And so what I love about Uber is that they've got rides and food delivery. I think that the potential synergies there, I don't think they've fully explored that. I know Dara and Uber has been talking a lot about these synergies between foods and ride. They talk about, hey, a driver can pick up food and then do a ride. And I'm a bit skeptical, I'll be honest. I think they're overselling the synergies a bit. We did a conference in LA in March called Curbivore at the Center of Food Delivery and Technology and Last Mile Players. We had an executive from Uber who's their VP of product for Uber and Uber Eats, Sachin Kansal. Myself was moderating. And then we had a local courier, this really funny lady named Barbara Watkins. And I asked her this question about driving for Uber and Uber Eats because she did Uber her first 5 years and then she switched to Uber Eats. And she literally was like, I don't want like stinky food in the back of my car right before I go and pick up a passenger because then they might rate you lower. So I think there's limited synergies, but I do think there are a lot of synergies that Uber can explore in the future. For example, you can actually onboard with Uber Eats in like 2 to 3 hours or less because there's no requirements. You onboard, you pass a quick background check, and you can literally like be out delivering versus with a vehicle, you know, with rides, you need to get a vehicle inspection, you need to pass a more stringent background check, you need certain age, vehicle requirements, and it might take a day or two. So it's sort of like like there are definitely some synergies there, but I think limited. I feel like Uber needs to do a better job exploring those synergies on both the driver and the customer side. But I mean, imagine a world in the future, a very basic world where you've got a killer discount between Uber Rides and Uber Eats, and you go over to DoorDash and they've got all the same restaurants as Uber Eats, but I can save 10 or 15% because I pay my monthly fee to Uber to bundle it all. Like, why would I use DoorDash in the future? So I feel like they need some rides component in the future. If I'm DoorDash, whether it's a partnership with Lyft, which I think would make a lot of sense, Lyft did a partnership with Grubhub, those sort of similar, or like you said, they kind of outright go and buy Lyft. So I think definitely I wouldn't be shocked if something like that happened in the future.
If we fall into a recession, let's say a 12 to 18 month recession, Lyft's market cap is probably going to go down around $4 billion. They're going to have massive layoffs. They're going to have to restructure the company. So somebody could probably take it out for, I'll just be very generous, $6 to $7 billion. That becomes very interesting for DoorDash, because if you look at what Uber's making these moves. You're at a sports stadium. Uber eats the food to your seat. They're becoming the brand. It goes back to my whole brand proposition. And Dara's public statements are wanting to become a super app. So hypothetically, DoorDash buys Lyft. They're merged together. They go through, they get all the antitrust approvals, and the company's won. How does Uber react?
I think that Uber is definitely touting this view of super app. I mean, there's sort of the obvious analogies to like WeChat in China and sort of these apps where you can do everything. You can do rides. You can do taxis. You can pay for a subway. I'm not convinced that that will kind of come here. I think that everything nature is a good growth story. Like, I'm pretty skeptical. I wouldn't say I'm skeptical. I think there's a long road ahead before Uber becomes some sort of super app. I think it's smart to invest in these other verticals and to try new things and see what sticks, because they sort of have a big advantage that, hey, they're doing a lot of rides. They're making money from that. They've got food delivery. They've got the two big categories down. And I think everything else is just sort of icing on the cake. I do think it could be valuable in the future. If, like, I think the reasons why I would sign up for Uber or use their loyalty package would be mainly rides, food, grocery, in sort of that order. And then all these other things I think are sort of sweeteners, like icing on the cake. Hey, I can rent a car with Uber. Hey, I can do a charter bus. It's like, I think all of those things aren't going to be primary drivers of growth, but I do think that they're nice to have, like medium to longer term. So I think that if Uber can nail those first two or three verticals, rides, food, and grocery, like, then they do become a pretty massive business in the future if they start adding, you know, if like 10% of their revenue is Uber Charter and Uber Park and Uber Stadium. Like, when you become a $100 billion company, you can kind of add that incremental revenue. I think that is really would work in their favor in the future. But I think there's a long road ahead before that comes true.
Okay, so we'll play chess. So Uber's getting ready to counteract these moves. I'm running DoorDash, I should make it. I'm going to go acquire a whole bunch of stadium concession operators. I'm going to kick out Uber Eats, and then I'm going to set up dedicated DoorDash / Lyft parking spots. And for a stadium and arena, since I'm the operator, I'm going to get a dedicated lane only for DoorDash Lyft vehicles. I'll start building a giant moat of profitability where you're not going to be able to compete. Then what does Uber do?
Well, I think the big question is, how profitable are these new verticals, these stadium concessions and Uber Charter and things like that that they're investing in? I think the real question is, like, is this actually a good idea? And I think they're much more sort of, let's throw some spaghetti on the wall and let's see what sticks. And if I'm DoorDash, I think the challenge is that, like, I don't think food delivery is that profitable for the reasons I mentioned. So I think if I'm Uber, I kind of have more cash to play around with things than DoorDash. And so I think that DoorDash has sort of been really well rewarded for their market share gains and things like that. But it does seem like DoorDash is sort of exploring a lot more. If you open the DoorDash app, for example, food delivery is still front and center, but they're experimenting with a lot of convenience. So this would be like 7-Eleven fast delivery, although I think they're pretty skeptical of that. Their COO, who's been on my podcast, Christopher Payne, and also he made a big announcement, I think, at one of the recent conferences that he's like very skeptical of 15-minute delivery, even though they're doing some experiments there. They've also got grocery convenience, right? So they've got these other verticals that they're sort of dabbling in, but I think they're revolving more tightly around consumables to your house versus Uber is sort of off in the more general mobility and logistics world, kind of dabbling in that stuff in addition to a lot of the consumables to your door space.
If either one of them could find out a way to charge you $20 or $30 for a beer like they do at a sports stadium, that's a very profitable business.
I guess, like, for me, I've always been a bit skeptical of the verticals that Uber has gotten into that are not rides or food delivery and even grocery. I mean, grocery delivery, I think, is now up there, but you can do a package delivery with Uber. You can rent a car. You can park your car. You can do concessions. I think that a lot of these synergies or opportunities sound great on paper. Like rides and delivery sounds great on paper. It sounds great in an investor call or PDF. Like, hey, we've got all these drivers. We got 3 million drivers and they can flip-flop between rides and delivery, but there's really limited opportunities where it might make sense. At the end of the day, if you've been doing rides all day and you're near your house, you flip to Eats because you're only going to get requests 3 to 5 miles away versus if you're taking a ride, you might get 30 miles away. You don't want to end 30 miles from your house if you happen to be there at the end of the day. Like, how many drivers actually know about that strategy? And then how many times does that actually come up? So I think there's pretty limited synergies. And I think a lot of these new verticals, I think they're worthy experiments, but I think they're just that. They're sort of like moonshots. You know, it's like, let's try a few of these things. I think it's important. I think it's a smart strategy to try them, but the odds of success are pretty low. And when you're a market share leader, I think, frankly, that's kind of what it takes to be innovating, right? To try to disrupt yourselves, to try to go into these new verticals. Whereas like the second players, the Lyfts or even the DoorDashes, like, I mean, I guess DoorDash and food, but Lyft compared to Uber, like they can't be messing around with all these other things. Like they need to be working on catching up to Uber, right? Because their network effect doesn't work as well. I shared this example that might be interesting to you and your audience about what I think is going on with Lyft right now. If you think about Los Angeles as like a 10 by 10 grid, 10 miles by 10 miles, and it's 100 square miles total. And let's say you needed 100 drivers to service that area effectively with 5-minute ETAs, and they're sort of evenly positioned. Like right now, Lyft doesn't have that 100 drivers. They only have 90 drivers. So even if you're charging drivers more because supply is not meeting demand, they still can't get to you in the 5 minutes that Uber can get to you. So it's like, not only are they charging more, but they're taking longer to get to you just because of geographically, like a city like LA, they don't have enough drivers. So I think the network and density effects are really being exemplified. So if I'm Lyft, it's like, oh man, we really got to focus on just getting back to like a place where our service is somewhat reliable. They're doing lots of rides and lots of trips still these days. It's just people are taking it because they can't get an Uber or they don't have a great alternative. Or it's like, hey, I take a Lyft every once in a while. Prices are high, but it's like, it's still an option. It's just nowhere near kind of as reliable as it was in a market like Los Angeles before the pandemic.
The rideshare market's Uber's to lose. And you mentioned several times different verticals, and we brought up Uber Freight earlier. So Uber Freight did $2.1 billion in revenue in fiscal year 2021, an increase of 11% year over year. The demand for freight is at all-time high. It's only growing. Does Uber take advantage of these market conditions to sell off Uber Freight, shore up their balance sheet, prepare for a potential recession?
That's not a bad idea. I mean, I think that before the pandemic, they were really moving towards selling off or consolidating a lot of these kind of exploratory verticals, like Uber Freight being a good example. That I think there's some, again, like some limited synergies to that being under, obviously, you've got the Uber brand, right? So it's like, hey, let's work with Uber Freight. Everyone knows Uber. Everyone knows what they do. So I think it's almost like a marketing or acquisition benefit more than anything. Like, I don't know, do they have some huge advantage when it comes to like the actual technology or the engineers that they're hiring? Like, I guess you would say less convinced there. And probably also, I don't know a ton about Uber Freight either, even though our most popular video on our YouTube channel with 6 million views is all about truck driving. I do know a thing or two about truck driving, but definitely not an expert like with Uber and Lyft. So these other verticals, like, I could see them sort of continuing to shed. And like you said, right, like I don't think it's freight, I think is almost like very tangential to the core business. I think what I'm looking for if I'm Uber is what are these experimental verticals that have synergies on the customer and or driver side. Like freight is almost like we're leveraging the technology. And I feel like the moat around that is pretty low.
Uber should, as you said, focus on their core business, which raises the big question, what's the future of the rideshare business?
The future of the rideshare business is that I think there's a lot of, I saw a bunch of articles in the past week or two that basically were kind of bagging on Uber and Lyft and saying, oh, how unprofitable they are. And I kind of completely disagree. I think that rides in itself as Uber, if Uber was just doing rides, I think that they'd be throwing off cash right now. I know that there's issues and with hiring drivers and bonuses they have to pay. But I mean, like I said, I'm a firm believer there aren't a lot of great alternatives. There's no competition. Like taxis are literally partnering with Uber like 7-8 years later. It's like they couldn't figure it out for themselves. So it's like, let's just go to Uber, right? And people want to get from A to B and lowest cost possible. You know, reliable and safe. And so I think that Uber definitely has sort of an advantage there. Sorry, I don't know. What was the original question before I went on my rant?
The rant was great. What is the future of the rideshare business?
I think the future is basically, hey, we're not going to see this exponential growth. I think that Uber is going to have to charge more. But I think at the same time, riders don't have a lot of great alternatives. So maybe you don't take as many rides as you did in the past. But if you need to get to the airport, it's a cost. Maybe you use pooling options or shared rides a little bit more to defray some of the costs. So I think we will see maybe a slower recovery to the number of rides they were doing pre-pandemic. But frankly, I think that it's still a very reliable and a sort of good option when you look out there at the sea of alternatives. I saw this article the other day in Vice, and the guy was talking about kind of bagging on Uber and Lyft and saying like, oh, there's all these great alternatives. You can bike or you can walk or you can take public transit. I'm like, huh? Those aren't real competitors. I think this notion of Uber competing with public transit or competing with biking, or there's tiny amount of crossover, but like going to the airport, for example, or going out on a Friday or Saturday night, these aren't rides where you're going to like bike or walk. This is like, you need a ride, you want to drink, you want to have fun. And so obviously some segments, you know, like airport travel and Monday through Friday rush hour haven't fully recovered because not as many people are going into the office, but there's still a lot of opportunity on the ride side. So basically going forward, future of rideshare, less demand, but they can still charge a lot for it. And so I think not going to be going 10x or 100x anytime soon. But I do think there's like slow and steady growth or potential going forward.
Uber has slow and steady growth today and they're raising prices. What happens when autonomous vehicles eventually scale? What happens to the pricing power then?
When autonomous vehicles eventually scale, I think that could be a big inflection point. Obviously, the question is when that will happen, how that will happen, where that will happen, and also if the business model, I mean, like obviously there's Cruise and Argo that are operating fully driverless vehicles, but if you have to put $500,000 worth of LiDAR equipment on top of it, maybe it's cheaper to just hire a driver and, you know, put them in the car. So I think there's obviously the technology is closer than ever, already here, frankly, in certain regions and certain limited capacities, but do the economics make sense? And so I think the inflection point will really be when it becomes close to cost competitive. I don't actually envision a world where it's all AV fleets, right? Because one of the things that Uber takes advantage of is that variable supply. If you have enough supply to meet demand on Friday night at 2 a.m., you've got way too many cars Tuesday at 3 p.m. And especially if you've got EVs and especially if you've got autonomous tech, those are going to be expensive cars at the start. So you're not going to be able to have a fully AV fleet and kind of balance that and the volume that Uber is doing. So I kind of see a big opportunity to really take that baseline where AVs are going to excel is to take that baseline. Maybe it's shorter rides. Maybe it's rides that drivers don't like. So on a minimum fare, for example, that's any ride that's 2 miles or less. Drivers might end up, Uber charges a passenger $8 or $9 for that ride. It's a minimum fare, 2 miles or less. The driver has to wait 5 minutes for the ride. They got to drive 5 minutes to the passenger, wait a few minutes for them to come out, give the ride for 5-6 minutes. Before you know it, you spent 20, 30 minutes. Uber takes a $3 fee off the top for their trust and safety fee or whatever they call it. And then they give you 75%. So you might end up with $3 for 30 minutes of work. So maybe there's limited opportunities like that to sort of, hey, human drivers don't want to do these. Let's have AVs take the load here and kind of handle that baseline demand. But human drivers or that variable supply of vehicles, right, that we can't pay for their downtime, they can come in when it's surge pricing or when drivers can make more, or passengers are willing to make more. But it could solve some of these issues that Uber is having trouble with. So I'm sure that I know they've kind of pivoted their strategy more than the partnership side, and I'm sure they're thinking about it. But the taxi example that I mentioned is a good one because Uber recently partnered with Curb, which is a big taxi provider, and also Flywheel, which is in San Francisco. I just had their CEO, Hansu Kim, on my podcast. And I think this makes a lot of sense because it opens up these thousands or tens of thousands of taxi vehicles onto the Uber platform. Riders now have the option like, hey, do you want a regular Uber or we can get you a taxi in half the time? Like, hey, I'll take a taxi if they can get here quickly and I get to still pay on the Uber app. And what do I care? I get some of these Ubers that I'm getting into aren't that great these days anyways. So I think that those opportunities that increase their supply, whether it's through partnership with taxis or through AVs in the future, when AVs are ready, like I can't see a better place to deploy them than Uber because they already have all the data and they already have the customers and all that. Like Tesla going out and starting an AV fleet, I mean, I think is kind of a joke because they're going to run into all the same issues that I just mentioned right there. I mean, you're going to need hundreds of cars to even have like a 15 to 20 minute ETA in a city like Los Angeles. And then what's the actual cost of that? Much less do Tesla owners actually want their vehicle being used by a bunch of people about to go out and puke in the back seat on a Friday night.
You get fined for that, as you documented in your book. So Uber's a platform. That's their advantage. They have all the data. we are going to have a hybrid approach where you have human-driven vehicles, you have taxis, and you will have autonomous vehicles. Do the economics make sense for autonomous vehicles and rideshare? Absolutely, 100%. They make zero sense today, unless you build on an experience, and we're not there yet. And that's a whole nother conversation for another day, Harry. We'll have you back on to talk about experiences.
That'll be our follow-up. Perfect.
There we go, Harry. And as we look to wrap up this super insightful conversation, what would you like our listeners to take away with them today?
I appreciate you having me on first and foremost. I really enjoy seeing you, chatting with you, reaching your audience, because I know you've got a dedicated following of industry experts and insiders. And I think a lot of times with conversations like this, you ask me a few questions and maybe I haven't thought of and even learn a thing or two myself. So if anyone wants to reach out with questions or just a chat, they can always shoot me an email, harry@therideshareguy.com. Twitter is a good place to get my unfiltered tweets. Just hit 10,000 followers there at The Rideshare Guy. And then also I'll give a shout out to my podcast because we do a lot of industry coverage of sort of what's going on, talking to executives. And really, I think for us, like I'm always trying to analyze these things. Like I'm not trying to be a financial expert on CNBC talking about the unit economics of the companies, but I am trying to bring that driver perspective. Like how are drivers thinking about these companies and reacting and what are they seeing? And how does that fit in to the larger narrative and sort of analyze things from that perspective? So hopefully we're doing a good job and we'll keep it up. I've been doing it for 8 years and I don't plan on going anywhere. So
fantastic. What's the name of the podcast?
The Rideshare Guy. Basically, if you type The Rideshare Guy or Uber driving or anything like that into a box on the internet, I should pop up. I even broke down recently and started a TikTok channel. So I think we've got a few videos that have over 10,000 views. So we're making a little waves, but less dancing and less music on our TikTok.
Harry's doing great. I am a proud subscriber of The Rideshare Guy podcast. I read Harry's book. I learned a lot and his blog posts are really insightful. So Harry, thank you for taking the time to educate the public, myself, Mr. Curiosity, on all things rideshare, because you're doing a great job. And may you have a wonderful another 8 years of rocking and rolling, because the future is bright, the future is autonomous, and the future is The Rideshare Guy. Harry, thanks so much for coming on The Road to Autonomy today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Autonomy podcast. If you've enjoyed listening, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Want to get in touch? Follow us on Twitter at Road to Autonomy or email podcast@brulteco.com. The Road to Autonomy is produced by Brulte & Company. The views and opinions expressed on the Road to Autonomy podcast do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Brulte & Company. The content discussed on this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, tax, investment, or business advice.